Here we go. So, it's my pleasure to welcome Curtis Blair, PhD, MSW, Enneagram practitioner and teacher to Many Rivers. I think this is our first Enneagram talk in 7.5 years, so it's long overdue. In this interactive lecture and discussion, Dr. Blair will provide an introduction to the Enneagram for those who are unfamiliar with it, and a demonstration of instant Enneagram type recognition. He is a biological scientist, he tells me a plant geneticist, and also is a clinical psychotherapist residing here in Sebastopol. So without further ado, welcome Dr. Blair. Thank you.
It's wonderful to be here. First time I've done this here. And I want to thank Many Rivers for providing such a lovely venue. Thank you. So, I'm partly here to introduce you and perhaps deepen your understanding of the Enneagram, but I'm also here to do something else. I'm here to bring you an opportunity of self-discovery. You see, Enneagram is sort of a focusing lens to look into the mirror of your own mind. So it's very nice to become expert and proficient with the Enneagram and to learn all the things it can tell you about other people, other people's architecture and motivation. But another thing is sort of a spiritual revelatory opportunity that's inherent in the Enneagram. So I'm here to present both of those things to you. And the thing I need from you is willingness, curiosity, adventurousness, to whatever degree you're comfortable. And so since part of this is an offer that I help you investigate your own Enneagram types, I want to say anyone who's willing, I will speak to what your Enneagram type might be. Anyone who's not so inclined, please say so. Any sort of show of hands or willing to... Anyone feeling adventurous? Okay. So this can be quite accurate, the things that can be recognized about people. So if anything gets the least bit intrusive or uncomfortable to you, just say, you know, it's enough. All right? So I will allow myself license to make observations as we interact, and I will expect that you guide me if that gets too transparent. Okay? Is there anyone here who's just here because they like going to these experiences and are completely unfamiliar with the Enneagram? No. So everybody here knows essentially what the Enneagram is.
A little.
Kind of.
A little.
Kind of. Okay. Okay.
We need some refreshing, or at least...
Sure. No.
Well, it's been quite a while since I...
Okay. My contention is that the Enneagram is essentially our ticket to experience a human life. By that I mean, what makes you disappear every night when you go to sleep? Or maybe you disappear from your customary venue and you wake up in a dream. And you become the person you find yourself in a dream, whether you're more or less the same as you normally are in your experience of yourself, but in a different setting. People are different, time is different, unfamiliar place. Or maybe you're completely different. Maybe you're a different gender. Maybe you're a child. Maybe you're radically different from what you're accustomed to experience yourself in a dream. But then when you wake up, you come back to the same person. Here I am again. My contention is that the Enneagram is sort of the default construct, the default architecture of your inherent identity self, the identity self that you default back to over and over and over. Has everybody seen the first Matrix movie? Okay. Well, so the main character in the movie, he discovers that his life has actually been a dream world. That his physical body is in a kind of a stasis. And the life he's been living is being fed to him as a programmatic experience. In that sense, my contention is that the Enneagram is sort of the construct, the identity construct that gives you an anchor, that gives you a self to come back to. Because if you didn't have that that anchor self, okay, this is me, I'm back being me, it would just be vastness. It would just be undifferentiated consciousness. And you wouldn't have a sense of a localizable self. You wouldn't have this locatable me that is so essential to human life. What the Enneagram proposes, and I believe it's true, is that this identity construct that we experience our life as, the me that we know ourselves to be, actually has a pattern to it. It has a basic architecture. The Enneagram is called the Enneagram, drawing the name from the Greek word for nine. So the Enneagram says there are nine basic predilections that make up the spectrum of human identity construct. There's a little added complexity to that in the sense that there's another issue called subtype, which many of you may not be familiar with. And there are three subtypes. So you have nine basic types and three subtypes for each of the nine. So that winds up giving you 3 times 7, 27 different basic constructs of identity that a human life can be lived through. And it's very interesting if you look at some ancient mystical traditions, like, for example, Vedic astrology and all of the intuitive arts of India. You find out that 6,000 years ago, the Indian tradition said, identity and mind, the persona, taking a persona upon yourself, is related to the moon. And they say the moon has a certain number of houses in the circle of the sky. And guess how many?
27.
Very interesting. The Indian tradition and many other traditions place a big emphasis on trinities. And the Enneagram is also built off of a trinity. That there's a kind of a root type, which the Enneagram calls a body type, or an instinctual type, or an earth-based type. And that this type sort of branches out into two other types. So you sort of get a trinity. So in the Indian tradition, it's Shiva is sort of the root. And then Brahma is the creator of possibility. And Vishnu is sort of the dancing force that keeps the whole system moving. What's analogous to this in the Enneagram is three basic groups. The earth-based, body-based, instinctual types. Three Enneagram types that are called head types. And three that are considered heart types. This also corresponds to what in the Indian tradition is Vata, Pitta, Kapha. Anybody's familiar with that? Ayurvedic medicine. Also, Tamas, Rajas, and Sattva. Sattva is thought to be the harmonizing force, the unifying force. Rajas is the ambitious, striving force. And Tamas is the divisive force of, I don't know if I can trust what's behind me. In other words, am I the universe and the universe is me? That's sort of Sattva. And the opposite extreme is Tamas, which is everything against everything else. You have to be very vigilant and careful. Is this making some sense? I'm sort of throwing a lot of disparate information out. So these nine types that make up the Enneagram, you can also sort of look at it as three types. Head type people, heart type people, and instinctual or belly type people. And there's a tremendous correspondence that head type people tend to be very vata. They tend to have a flutteriness, very active minds. They're very acutely affected by things. And belly type people, instinctual people, tend to be more calm, more imperturbable, more massive. And the bodies correspond with that. Head type people tend to be long and lean and thin. And belly type people tend to be denser. And if you look at them, their center of gravity is sort of lower. And what I threw out in the title of this is the transparent Enneagram. And what I'm leading up to is that if one is very adept at sort of synthesizing all of these attributes of the different types, the Enneagram becomes quite transparent, that you can sort of see people and have a basic sense of what their Enneagram construct is. Any questions so far?
Yes. It sounds very much like what they talk about the body types.
Yes, yeah.
Ectomorphs and endomorphs and mesomorphs.
Yes, I think that was sort of a dead end in trying to understand human experience, but it had certain merit to it. It has mm-hmm. certain validity. There was a recognition that these body typologies indicated something about the energetic currents and the experiential quality and the dynamic expression of the personhood that went with that body. And so, yes, it is related. So as I look out at you, some of you, I would say, with greater than 90% probability, I know what your Enneagram types are. Yeah, it is.
From body type?
Thank you for saying that.
From body type? Just from looking at us?
Yeah, just from look, yes.
What's the third? You said head type, belly type, and...
Heart type.
Heart.
Okay. So, yes, that's scary. And anybody who feels uncomfortable about that, just tell me right now not to direct that observation towards you. I'd be happy not to. Okay. And then some of you, I have probably better than 90% certainty of what your Enneagram type is. type is. And then some other view, I would need to talk with you, I would need to interact with you, and gather some more data. But as to sort of putting you in the three major groupings of head, heart, or belly, or body type, probably all of you, I could, within, you know, 90% certainty, identify where you are with that. So, anybody like to volunteer to sort of start this out? Yes.
I'll volunteer. Okay. I've got confused what number I am, so I'm really curious.
Okay. I would say you're either a 5 or a 6.
Yeah, so would I. So you think a 5 with a strong 6 wing, or a 6
that
would
be
a strong
that would
five?
Be my first guess. My
5 with a strong 6?
Yes. The 5 looks stronger in you, but there's a lot of 6.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could easily be a 6 with a 5 wing, but I think you present more as being a 5 with a 6 wing.
Would you kind of go through the numbers for those of us who've kind of forgotten what they are? Because
certainly.
When you're saying that about her, I'm trying to figure out what that is. I think I remember the 5, but I can't remember what a 6 is.
Okay. My sense is that you're a 5. Fives, we'll just start with that since that's what we're talking about. Fives value knowing. They are the master accumulators of knowledge. Their treasure, their life treasure, is elite knowledge, not mundane knowledge, but elite knowledge that warrants a regard as precious. Fives are the intellectual athletes of the Enneagram. Because they value probing deeper and deeper to expose the mysteries of what life is, what the universe is, and how things work, they gather and they explore and they gather and they explore, and they love books and they love all avenues that deepen knowledge. The other side of five is that part of this, and this is true of all of the types, is that we grab a hold of type as a reactive defense. Every one of the 9 Enneagram types grabs their type as a reactive defense. The reactive defense system of the 5 is a sense that the universe is vast, energetically huge, and essentially ruthlessly uncaring. That it just churns out birth and death and change with no regard for your preferences. And so something about the 5 just feels very, very small in a very huge universe that doesn't care. And somehow the energetic response, the strategic response, is to self-empower through knowledge. And so a 5 becomes a connoisseur, a collector, an accumulator of deep knowing, and is always trying to know more. And the wish is essentially, the ultimate expression is, if I know everything, then I would, the universe would be my home, you know? Instead of being in a exposed position to the vicissitudes of whatever might happen, I would see it coming. I would be omniscient, and then there would be safety. And
that's interesting, because they say what science is to predict and control.
Yes.
And you're saying almost exactly what someone's trying to do.
Yes.
Way. They're trying to predict and control something which probably is not predictable or controllable.
Yes.
They're very scientific.
Yes. So it's kind of a futile treadmill, but it isn't futile because it's what fosters the exploration of life along a certain path. And it's also not futile in the sense that it's very comforting. If you feel exposed and you engage yourself in inquiry and discovery and accumulation of knowledge, you feel empowered and you're more able to enjoy the journey. And ultimately, from an existential point of view, It doesn't remediate the disturbance that started the whole thing. It palliates. It doesn't remediate.
I really liked it.
Yeah.
I'd say on my very worst days, I think it's absolutely what you said about the universe is completely neutral, I guess.
Yes.
But I want very much to believe that it's somehow benign. God is love and all
right,
that.
Right,
there's a
right.
great deal of learning. Yeah. You're very right, but the last person I heard talk about this, which was several years ago, defined five in an entirely different way. These are the loners who are afraid of other people and never interact, and that was not me at all. The way you describe it is very accurate. I'll give you
Thank
a very
you.
High mark for that.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I do the Enneagram somewhat differently. Most presenters, teachers, authors on the Enneagram try to bring you to the recognition of the Enneagram by describing patterns of behavior of all these types. And it is true that fives, for example, because they're very sensitive to intrusiveness. I could upset the hell out of you in no time flat if I started to intrude in your sphere of private personal space. Fives are just very sensitive to that. And so because that is true, fives tend to get identified by people who aren't fives. You know, you're not as gregarious as I, or you're more private, you're secretive, you're exclusionary, you're not available 24/7, you know, I have to go through some sort of protocol to find out if you're available. And, you know, I call out to you and you reply with an email. You know, but those things are true of collectively fives.
Only to those that we don't
want
to interact with.
Ah, so you know you're a five.
If we
want to
interact with them,
yes.
we phone them back.
Yes, yes. Right. But it's on your terms.
Uh-huh.
I'm always available, and you're only available according to your disposition. Mm. And I need to try to make you feel guilty about that.
So are you saying that you perceive that I'm a five?
Yes.
Not a six.
No.
Okay. Again, what's the difference? Do you see yourself as a five? Is he?
I see a lot of myself as a five, but what came up just this last weekend with a woman who is actually doing a lot of the work with the Enneagram said, you talk a lot, and you're social, and you interact, and you share information about yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it gets. There's a lot. I'm trying to keep the bones that you know the big bones of the skeletal structure of this in greatest prominence, and it gets complicated in the expression of type because of many other factors. I don't want to throw out too much jargon, but whatever type you are is affected by the adjacent types, the type on this side of your Enneagram type and on this side. on the wheel of the Enneagram. And so depending on whether you're colored by the Enneagram type on this side or the Enneagram type on this side, you will look different in your type. And then there's also the factor of the subtypes. One subtype is much more accepting of risk. They're much more, do high stakes gambling.
Not the self-preservation type.
And then the self-preservation type is much more cautious, much more deliberate, much more measured in their willingness to take on risk. So if you have, as we have here, perhaps two female fives in the same room at the same time.
Three.
Okay, three, sorry. So I don't want to leave you out. But they may look very different because of their willingness to put themselves at risk, the degree to which uncertainty causes energetic contraction, and what wings, what adjacent numbers are prominently influencing.
And is there factors involved in just acknowledging it at one point and realizing it's not beneficial and moving?
Yes.
A little bit.
Yes.
Using that and knowing that, and then as knowing that, I was like, well, this isn't getting me what I am wanting out there. So what tools do I need, or what am I doing and change so you appear different than
five? Right. But remember, we're talking about the construct of your identity. Okay?
Right, and then so that's why I use the word I appear
different
than a five.
So the catch is this, that if you come to see in sharp clarity what the construct of your identity is, and you decide to employ an intent for change, what authority is going to enact and supervise that intent for change? It's the construct you've already got. So it's sort of like having a paint roller in your hand and decide, I want to stop spreading this paint everywhere. But the only thing you have is this paint roller. So everything you do adds more. So the catch is, a feature has to be employed that's sort of like the moment you wake up in the morning, before you realize who you are, before you realize where you are, before you sort of take on the mantle of your identity. Like the paper that remains underneath all the printing in the newspaper. To really employ an opportunity to broaden and change the construct, you have to embrace a sense, a very powerful sense, that what you really are is the matrix, the paper that holds the imprint of your identity construct, which in a sense neutralizes your claim to being your identity construct. And that creates the opening, the possibility. The way an actor, a good actor, removes their identity, becomes something sort of neutral, and then adopts the motivations and the psyche and the construct of the character they're trying to act. So, yes, it's very doable, but you can't think your way to it. It's kind of tantric, in the sense that you have to embrace some energetic other than thought.
Yeah.
Because what is thinking your thoughts is your identity construct. So it engenders no chance of change. That makes sense.
What type are you?
What do you think?
Five.
No.
Four.
Nine.
What type do you think you are?
No, you told me first.
You're nine. So am I.
Are you?
Mm.
Cool.
Actually,
as far as I know, I'm nine.
Well, I would be surprised. I would be surprised. Because you don't seem like a five. You know, in the really astute people who teach Enneagram typing, say there's some types that tend to be look-alike types, and five and nine are look-alike types. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because they have an energetic constraint to appear on the scene. Okay? Five tends to be held back, trying to observe and map and know. So they're sort of quiet. They're not charging around trying to reshape the context. They tend to be more observers. And nines tend to be passive and observant in a way that's very similar to five, but for a very different motivational reason. They don't feel like they got an invitation to be here.
Now, is this heart? Or
no, that's belly. That's belly.
Nine is
belly.
And
five is head. Okay, I should say that. To go around the wheel of the Enneagram, oh, that's great. Maybe a little small. Oh, this is fine. Can everybody see that? The circle of the Enneagram?
Can't read it.
Okay, great. The 3 points of this figure, the 3 points at the top, those are the belly or instinct types. And then the types on this side are the head types. And the types on this side are the heart types. So to just speak through it, 8, 9, and 1 are the belly type, instinct types. 2, 3, and 4 are the heart types. And 7, 6, and 5 are the head types.
Ask. Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, great. Well, you're one of the tough ones in the room.
Okay.
So I need you to tell me more than I can see without asking you questions. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you at the moment when you said, I'm ready?
Fabulous. Wonderful.
Okay.
Good.
How did it come about?
I'm ready to anything, right?
Right.
Anything. Well, get married, have children.
Yeah, you're ready.
Go into therapy, whatever.
It's like, woo. You became go, right?
Yeah.
You became go.
It was positive.
Right.
Very
right.
Positive. Yeah, very.
What?
Motivation.
What caused it? What caused it?
I don't know.
You don't know. Okay?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's just like my nature.
Right. So, a very significant decision was made. A resolve came about that was go, and it felt good.
Mm-hmm.
But your senses, you didn't create it. It sort of came to exist in you.
Well, it was my decision that set me on a path.
Mm-hmm.
So I would take credit for that, mm-hmm. my decision.
Right. Okay, so what was the rational process that led you to that decisiveness?
This is what I need. This is what I want. This is what I...
Based on what rationale?
I don't know.
You don't know. That's beautiful. It's beautiful. And you know that you don't know, right? So your big decisions come about, and if there was snow on the ground, there'd be no footprints that led you to the stepping off point. It's like you're just suddenly there and you're ready to step off. Can anybody else notice that perhaps that's not the way that you reach decisions?
So is this in an intuitive?
She said,
it's my nature. I think most of us feel it's just what we are. I don't know.
Well,
even the five.
I think it's true. I think it's true for everyone. And ultimately, there's something universal underneath these sort of templates that we wear. Mm-hmm. That's part of the whole picture. So maybe it's good to say that we're all more similar than we are different. But nevertheless, these differences are very real. Many people, especially head type people, have a sense that, okay, I had this thought, and the logical following thought was this thought, and this thought, and then I reached a conclusion this is the best thing to do. Belly type people, instinct type people, tend to think a lot of thoughts that just sort of, they're not linked together like links in a chain. They kind of swirl around, and then suddenly there's a sense, okay, I'm going to do this. That's sort of like pulling a rabbit out of a hat. Mm-hmm. So what you're telling me is there's a good chance that you are one of the belly-type, instinct-type person. Mm-hmm. So if I accept that hypothesis, it might not be true. Mm-hmm. You might be a head-type person with a strong link to one of the belly types. But we'll just sort of follow this thread that you're showing up like an instinct-based person. So I'm going to take a wild guess and say you're either a 9 or a 1. Okay? And you have, whatever you are, you have a lot of 1. That you try to do things right. You try to plan things. It drives you crazy. Right?
Yeah.
And you know what... you know what Eisenhower said about planning?
No.
Okay, he planned the biggest enterprise in human history, mm-hmm. the invasion of France.
Right.
He said, planning is useless, but indispensable.
Because in the world, you don't really know what the outcome is going to be.
Right.
But it's hard work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's if you really want things to go right, if the reason you plan is you want things to go right, mm-hmm. you invest energetically, very heavily, yeah. in that planning. Mm-hmm. And then when you don't get cooperation because of, you know, inevitable variables, or worse yet, people don't cooperate with you. They don't take the plans as seriously as you took them. They deviated from the protocol that you had carefully mapped out. There's a kind of a... volcanic of people. And you don't want to blow the cap off the mountain because that would be vulgar. So there's a kind of a implosional explosion. And it's painful, right? And everybody who knows you well, who's around you when you're suffering that volcanic explosion where the lava doesn't really vent, they know to tread softly and give you a wide berth until you recuperate.
Okay.
Okay.
Have we got to the personal boundaries?
It's all true. What can I say?
Well, and you do it out of a loving spirit of stewardship.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you take this stewardship as very serious business.
Very serious. Yeah.
And so the people who may shrink away from you when they know you haven't gotten the cooperation you needed, they also know at some level that it's a loving, life-affirming, supportive purpose that you are engaged in this task
right.
from the beginning.
They know it's not based in meanness or
right.
hostility
right.
towards.
But they still don't want to get too close to you when the volcano is rumbling.
Doesn't sound very good.
Whoa, why? Okay, so what we've been saying just now is emphasizing the one belly type person energy more than the nine.
Yeah.
And you're giving such a florid affirmational response that, you know, I can kind of surmise that you're telling me you are a one with a nine wing as opposed to a one with a two wing. And it is hard for you to relax, but when people can sort of usher you towards a context and a venue and a setting that really affirms to you there's no work to do, that once you get relaxed, it's really rejuvenative and pleasant. But it's hard, because the work is never done, right? Work is never done. So it's hard to put that out of your mind.
Yeah. So what are the learnings for a one?
Well, that's getting very specific, and I would like to tell you, but I want to make sure we have time to...
Sure. Yeah.
Then if we have time, I'd be more specific. We don't allow that. No. You can't volunteer someone else.
You have to be out in here.
Do you know the Enneagram pretty well back there?
Yeah, a little bit. My aunt has given me a few books. So. You can do me if you want. What do you think I am?
We've kind of gone back and forth.
Yeah.
Do you really like books?
I do.
Yeah.
Quite a lot. I'm an English major.
Uh-huh.
And I'm interning as a journalist.
Uh-huh.
So into language, definitely.
So is it this insatiable appetite for knowledge with you?
I do identify with that. I feel like I'm on the 5-6 border.
Mm-hmm.
With you, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
Would you go one way or the other, or?
I don't know. I'd have to talk with you more.
Okay.
There's some little whiff of one that you might have some one traits, but maybe that's sort of a learned predilection, that because you like language and because you like knowledge, mm-hmm. that you've sort of entrained yourself to try to. You know, dot the I's and cross the T's and you know, sort of know the rules of codified protocol to get things right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But that you don't have that inner volcanic drive that ones have to sort of be the engineer in charge of the train to make sure it stays on the tracks.
Okay.
So ones feel this huge responsibility. That they're like world stewards. So whatever they see, they feel some urge to shoulder the responsibility of stewardship for things. And you seem a little bit more quiet in your energy, more of a consumer of knowledge, rather than that sort of style.
Okay.
So you're self-confident, but you're shy, right? You're sort of understated. You're not brash.
Yeah.
And you enjoy all things intelligent.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So would you like to write books?
I would, or some sort of writing, you know, or publishing or journalism, which has a lot to do with accumulating knowledge and then organizing it. And when you're talking about that, I was thinking about that process, and that seems very five-ish to be attracted to something like that.
Yeah, it's kind of five-ish.
Okay.
What is six? You keep talking about five and six,
okay.
And I don't know what six is.
That's a very appropriate question. All three of the head types feel some sort of unsettling concern about whether or not the world, the universe, can be trusted. It's like Einstein said, you know, one of the only questions really worth investigating is the universe friendly? And there's something in the makeup of all three of the head type Enneagram styles, 5, 6, and 7, that basically has a predetermination. A decision is made that, you know, you really can't trust it. The universe, the world, that the universe isn't vested in your best interest. You are vested in your best interest. They may not carry any weight with the disposition of the universe. Therefore, you have to be the advocate for your security, safety, well-being. And then those three types that basically are mistrustful of the what's around the next corner, they take different approaches. The five tries to be all-knowing. The seven tries to pretend it's not possible that anything can be wrong. One of the stories that goes with seven is a seven child is with their parents in a busy shopping mall, and something happens where they get separated, and the parents go one way and the child goes another. All of a sudden, the seven child finds himself, oh my God, I'm all alone, and that there's a jolt of anxiety. This might not be safe. This might not be good. And then they quickly, improvisationally look around and they see a toy store. And they put all fear out of their mind. They rush into the toy store. And when the parents find the child and they're all upset and, oh my God, where were we? We lost you. The child says, what? What? You know? So you just completely fill their mind with fascination and joy and entertainment to crowd out all fear. And then, so the seven is sort of creatively avoidant of fear and threat. The five sort of takes it on of, you know, when I know everything, I'll be fortified in a satisfactory way. And the six sort of takes the path of toughness. Like, okay, it's going to be hard, but I can handle it. Just, you know, hit me, beat me, hurt me. I can take it. I'll surprise you. You know, and I'll think up the bad things you can do to me. I'll think them up myself, and I'll head you off. So it's sort of Murphy's Law, you know. You sort of become a student of Murphy's Law, and then you're ready for the attacks of the universe. Might be you? You feel
what?
You think you might be a six?
No.
No.
My mom, I did.
We were talking about her mom. What do you think I am?
You're not one of the more readable people. I sort of had to entertain three possibilities for you. Two, six, or nine. And you're telling me you don't see yourself as a six. So I have to sort of go with two or nine. Either of those feel?
Yeah, I actually know what I am, but I wanted to play the. I just wanted to see what you kind of observe.
You can also be a one. There are nine with a one wing, or a one with a nine wing. Something in that 9-1-2 area.
Do you want me to tell you?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm a nine.
Yeah.
But I was curious, like, if I had a one.
Yeah, you do. Oh, definitely. Because if things get too disorganized, you know, it eats away at you.
I think I've changed. Not that my type has changed,
right.
But
the expression.
I wouldn't say I was very one-ish as a young adult, child into adult.
Right.
But I've kind of changed.
Right. Yeah. As you wield more concerns, as you're trying to govern more endeavors, mm-hmm. you have to, you know, self-discipline to police the details.
And I think the knowledge of the Enneagram has made me see things and decide not to, like, immediately go there, which is really wonderful.
Yeah. It can be a very, very healing discovery to know what you're... Enneagram type is.
So would you say she was a five with a strong six wing? So, I mean, if that's okay for me.
Yeah, no. Go.
Well, certainly more six than four.
Do you think he plays me more as like the five with the six wing more than the six with the five wing?
I don't know. I'd have to spend because it. Right. You've got a lot of each, and okay. It would take some investigation to really.
Right. Be sure. What is this? What
you do? Like walk around in the mall and it's like.
Do you consciously do that?
No, it's not even conscious anymore.
The numbers just come up.
What is four?
Okay.
Did five, six, and one, five, four on the other.
Okay. So. I just sort of said how the three head types are all in a mistrustful response to their sense of the universe, right? The same is true for the three heart types. But in this case, the mistrustful concern is a sense of whether some invisible conduit or cable of love is intact or broken. So with the head types, it's, is the universe going to mistreat me? Probably yes, if I'm not careful. With the heart types is, does the universe love me? And the doubt is maybe not. Okay. So what all three of the heart types are trying to do is be unforgettable or impossible to dismiss. And the way the fours do it is by being sort of shadowy and unavailable, mysterious, intriguing. Angelina Jolie, she's so prominent in movies, you know, you see her. It's very shadowy, you know? It's very sort of elusive. It's like you can see her, but you can't get a feel for her. She's a four. Barack Obama is a three. The approach that threes take is, I can do anything. And by doing what no one else can do. I'm vital. I'm unforgettable, indispensable. I'm significant, and I will feel loved because I accomplished the impossible.
Not if you're president, you'll never feel loved, no matter what.
That's
my but, you know, you can try. You can
even
try.
If he's wrong.
Well, and then you have Tiger Woods. He's a 3-2. And he tried to be unforgettable to many women in addition to sports fans.
And Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And what's the other
Arnold Schwarzenegger! Yes! He's a 3. Most people don't know that.
He plays an 8 in the movie, so some of the Enneagram authors think he's an 8. But he's
hey,
not.
You are good.
Right.
Yeah, he's a
what
3.
What about Maria? Maria.
She's a 6. So, 6 is, you know, that mustering out, being forthright, you know. When push came to shove, and she had to go against her Republican husband mm-hmm. and support Barack Obama mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. go against, you know, support the female who's mm-hmm. trying to be president, she just came out
just
and
did it.
Just did it.
Yeah.
It's what she had to do. Mm-hmm. With great trepidation and
sure.
quakiness, but... You know, it's a sort of a soldiering quality to being a 6. Mm. Okay? Yeah. Yes?
Oh, just type.
He wants you
to oh, you'd like to know your type. Well, you give a pretty clear presentation of yourself, that you're 6 and 7. You have both of those going on, and I can't tell which is more your root type. The optimism, the playfulness, the joyfulness, when things get sour and heavy, you know, sort of turn your attention toward the place where the sun is shining. That's 7. And you've got a lot of that. It's like there's no point in getting bogged down. You know, if we can't get any traction here, there's prospects elsewhere. But you also have a lot of 6 of, you know, life is showing up. Life's showing up, and recognizing what needs to be done, and sort of certain amount of plodding through the duty and the work and the you know the struggles, and so you've got both of those left hand. You're sort of ambidextrous. You have both those going on, and I can't really gauge which is the root for you. Do you guys know each other? So you probably know. So we don't know whether you're 6 or 7, but you have a lot of 7 in you.
Yeah.
You probably know that the buoyant playfulness of 7 can really aggravate a 1 when they're feeling serious.
Yeah.
Right? So when you see the game face, you know, the serious face is on, you don't want to say, well, the sun is shining somewhere. You know, you save that for later. Right?
I try.
Yeah. So when it most seems like what needs to be pointed out is that the sun is shining somewhere, that's the time not to say it. And wait until there's some sense of the clouds parting and then offer that upbeat. So these are how we paint the tapestry of our life with these energies and attentional.
You never got to 2 when you were talking about the heart.
Thank you.
You gave us 4 and 3.
So Oprah is a good example of a 2. That's sort of she's unforgettable. She maintains this conduit of interactive love connection and heart-centered significance. By showing her vulnerability, by showing her nurturance and kindness for people, by not being judgmental or harsh or combative. But she has a tremendous facility for three, which is, you know, the huge accomplisher. So everybody has a sense of Oprah as being, she's like me, you know, she has flaws and vulnerabilities and emotional aberrations and pitfalls of life. But at the same time, she's incredibly financially successful and a powerhouse of authority over what gets broadcast over the airwaves. So she's a mixture of two and three.
The two are the more nurturant types?
Yes. They tend to put the needs of others somewhat before their own. Whereas the style of three, being significant, sort of says, hey, everybody, follow me.
Shine.
And support me so I can accomplish. And the style of the four is, I have the courage to face the pain and the horror and the angst of life that you all are too self-protective to traumatize yourself with. So I will feel the angst and the pain, the pathos and the horror of life. And it makes me beautiful, makes me special, makes me distinctive.
The poet that writes kind of, you know, how hard life is.
The angst of the artist is sort of an essential food for beauty.
Think, see how these like personality types. There's somebody out there that goes something.
Mind types are distrustful of the universe because they think it's kind of a harsh place, and heart types are kind of distrustful, but they're from the point of view: am I going to be loved or not?
Right.
So, am I going to be safe?
Right.
Am I going to be loved?
Right.
What about the belly types?
The belly types. They're very uncomfortable feeling like clay in a mold. They feel like if you step out onto the stage of life, the quality of the landscape and the events that are transpiring are going to shape you. And belly types feel very uneasy about becoming what the world shapes them to be. So the way ones do that is, I know what's right, and I will struggle to not let the chaos and disorder and wastefulness and violence of the world make me in its image. I will be a steward and a warrior on behalf of beneficence and order and goodness and well-being. The eight, which is the sort of opposite extreme of the three belly types, says, try it. You know, world, do your damnedest. I will not cooperate. In fact, I will overpower you. I will do whatever I damn well please, and we'll see what happens. And the nine sort of says, is there any way I can get out of all of this? Why is it so much struggle?
Yeah.
Everybody should get along.
Yeah. That's beautiful. What's his name, King?
Rodney King.
Yeah.
Right? After all of that, of trauma, the horror of what he had ignited, right? Mm-hmm. He was a catalyst to all sorts of violence, and people mm-hmm. died, and people were mutilated.
He didn't ignite it.
Well,
he was involved in it.
But from a nine's point of view, the event that transpired around him did ignite it. And nines feel responsible when they're linked to anything bad that happens. So what did he do? He didn't get up there and say, yeah, those terrible cops, did you see how they beat me? He said, okay, can't we all just get along? Mm-hmm. Can't we all just back away from this drama that's on fire? Can't peace reassert itself? So you're absolutely right. He was a nun. Clearly, clearly. Do you remember? Do you remember that 12-year-old girl who was kidnapped in Petaluma?
Polyclass.
And killed. The man who abducted her and used her to his, you know, feed his appetite, and then he disposed of her. He was an ape.
He's
an ape. And please be careful with this. Is that I'm not meaning to say that apes are malicious, hateful, evil sociopaths.
Yeah.
Sociopaths come in all Enneagram types. But the thing is, when you get sociopathy with an ape, and the basic makeup of eight is I'm going to do whatever I'm able to do, and nothing intimidates me.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have a really bad situation. And a story about him is that when he was sentenced, and Polyclas's family is all there, you know, people had lost this beautiful child. After he got his sentence, I think he got a death sentence, I'm not sure. As he got up and he was being taken out of the courtroom, he looked at the audience. There was all kinds of people from all walks of life, but especially her family. And he went like this.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. Now, I only bring that up to show you that the core of eight is, I don't care how much you hate me. I don't care that I've just gotten a death sentence. I don't care about the horror that I inflicted. I am unaffected. I refuse to be affected. I refuse to care.
Can you give us another example of an eight?
I don't think he is an eight, actually. I think he's a three. I think Martin Luther King is a three. A three.
Drug dealers would be eights, I would think.
People who are willing, people who are able to shrug off the censure and the condemnation of the surrounding culture and do their own thing and not feel curbed or constrained by disapproval. So a lot of them are eights. But another question was, another example of an A is Tommy Lee Jones, the actor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful example of an A. You know, where all of that strength of, I will do what I am moved to do, no matter how favorably or unfavorably it's validated by the surrounding context, and have no doubt of it. I will do what I choose to do, but in a very beautiful, kind, you know, distinguished value system. That's also a.
How would you type Robert De Niro?
He's a counterphobic six.
What? Counterphobic?
Yep. I'm sorry. I'm really glad you asked that question, because. Yeah. One of the really important things that I've forgotten to mention so far is that there are an awful lot of sixes. And another thing I've forgotten to mention is that in distribution, it's not symmetrical. The distribution of types is not symmetrical at all. Probably somewhere around 45% of the human population are six.
Ooh, really?
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
Really? Because, from a Darwinian sense, what is the most elemental root concern?
Survival.
That is what most people are deeply affected by as their concern. And so you see more people wearing the 6 Enneagram type. Then the other part that I need to mention is that there's nothing more acutely painful than fear. To be frightened is painful. I mean, like, physiologically painful. And it creates such an imperative. You know, what am I going to do? Because I don't want to get out of bed. I don't want to move when I feel anxious. Because I feel like whatever I do will just make it worse. A large number of the people who have the 6 Enneagram type, they cope with the pain of fear by becoming counterphobic. You looking at me? Mm-hmm. You looking at me? Mm-hmm. So the way to overcome your fear is to charge at it. Mm-hmm. And the sort of adrenaline vibrancy negates the feeling of fear.
Jumping out of airplanes.
Bush senior.
Yes.
Bush junior.
Yes. Yes. Oh. Both of them are 6s. I agree.
Both counterphobic.
W is counterphobic. Yes.
Bring it on.
Bush.
I would guess.
You spend a lot of time at Toy Story, don't you?
Can't spell toy.
Buying his cowboy costume. But Bush Senior is more phobic than W. He is much more constrained, much more deliberate, much less violently charging at a perceived threat. He was much more adroit at not turning the presidency into his own reactive psyche.
Clint Eastwood
is a really interesting case. He must have had an 8 father or something that imprinted 8s on him. Because in his Dirty Harry movies,
yeah,
he's being an 8.
Right.
You know?
Right.
One of us is going to die.
Make my day.
So that absolute disregard for how, you know, mm-hmm, how this may play out. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. That's 8. But he's actually counterphobic 6, doing a very good imitation of an 8. And as you see Clint Eastwood getting older and making his more mature movies, mm-hmm, like Million Dollar Baby, if mm-hmm you saw that, it's so clear that he's a counterphobic 6 who has been hurt by fighters that he loved who abandoned him, fighters that he loved who got injured, where he felt responsible and he didn't protect, and you know, broke his heart when he failed to succeed in protecting this girl who trusted him. And so I think he's showing us that he's aware of himself now as that it's fear and loss that is the architecture of his psyche, not this bravado, this counterphobic.
I volunteer.
You volunteer? I think you're a 5 or 6. You've got 5 and 6 both going on. And you have more 6 than the lady sitting. I mean, you have more 6 than 5 relative to the lady sitting next to you. Right. She has 5 and 6 with the 5 more prominent. Mm-hmm. You have 5 and 6 with the 6 more prominent. And I think that you probably have the style of 6 that is not counterphobic, that tries to be useful and tries to meet the uncertainties and vicissitudes of life with careful, deliberate, steady, cogent work to make things as right as they can be. And that makes you a vital, life-supportive agent. And who would want to attack or threaten someone who's so nice. So there's actually a name given to all of these combinations of Enneagram type and subtype, and I think you're a warm six is what it's called. Mm-hmm. Self-preservation predilection, six. It just, you try to meet the world as responsibly and adaptively as possible, and try to minimize conflict and violence.
Do you see correlations between astrological positions? And
yes. Yeah.
What kinds of things do you
know? Well, see, I don't know Western astrology at all. I'm a Vedic astrologer, the Indian tradition of astrology. And in Vedic astrology, I see certain associations that correlate between Enneagram and Vedic astrology.
Now I'll drop the other shoe. Robert De Niro's chart and mine are identical within a couple of degrees. Mm-hmm. Our ascendant and everything.
Mm-hmm. So I think you're a six. And somehow Robert De Niro emphasized the, I don't know, maybe it's just his acting. Maybe you're more alike than you look, because we know Robert De Niro through his adopting these, you know, charging at the fear, charging at the threat. But I think you're probably both sixes with that astrology.
When I tell people that our charts are virtually identical, I tell them that the only difference is he knows when he's acting.
You've talked a lot about the nine types, and I know we don't have too much time, but could you at least name the three subtypes that get us to the 27?
Yes, I'd be very happy to. Thank you. Subtype is different than Enneagram number. Okay? Subtype is sort of independent of this style of concern. How am I going to do this dance of life and be successful? Okay? And one of the subtypes is called self-preservation. Self-preservation people tend to have a very conscious sense of their bubble of safety. And so they move in a very moderate, modulated way. And they tend to have a quality of not wanting to take big risks. And they tend to not want to experience shortages. So self-preservation people will have stuff. And you look underneath the kitchen sink, and they'll have several bottles of dishwashing liquid so they don't run out. They'll have, you know, backup toilet paper. And they need a certain cushion of a certain amount of money and security resource, or they feel uncomfortable. And so a lot of life attention is dedicated to maintaining whatever those points of reference of adequacy, comfort are. The other extreme from that are the subtype called one-to-one. And one-to-one means these people are driven to have very, very intense, narrow laser beam focus of attention interactions with the world. Okay.
Is that also the sexual?
That's sexual. Yes, sexual subtype. Because the major expression of being one-to-one is sexuality. Okay. So, picture two friends who are sitting down to eat in a restaurant, and one of them is leaning across the table trying to make eye contact, And the other one's looking at their plate. You want to tell me what the subtypes would be?
Actual self-preservation.
Yeah, yeah. Which is which?
Looking down at the plate is self-preservation.
Yeah. It's like, what have I got here? What did the waiter bring? Yeah. Does it look good? Am I glad I ordered it?
I won't die.
Yeah. What's going on here? What's going on here? And if you're a one-to-one person, you're like, why are we having dinner together? You're looking at your plate. You're supposed to be here for me.
Right.
Me. Okay? Then the third subtype is called social subtype. And social subtype people are very identified with the larger life frame that they live in. Family, community, school system, police force, member of the military, living on the base. It's like, well, there's me, but me is not really me. Me is the extended web of humanity that I'm a part of. My family, the Air Force, the police force, the bar association, the school board, you know, my community, my extended self, right? Mm-hmm. So we'll add the social subtype person to that table, and the social subtype person is looking around the room. They're taking in, what are they eating? What time is it? What's the clock say? I think I know that person. And that doesn't compute to either the self-preservation person or the one-to-one person. Okay? And they're all being put out with each other. Right? The social subtype person is wondering, you know, why are they just looking at the food, you know? Right? I don't get that. And then the social subtype person notices that the one-to-one person is in a huff, because the one-to-one person just noticed that the social subtype person was looking at the clock. And said, like, wait a minute, if you're looking at the clock, then you're not really wanting to be here with me. So I'm put out. You're not giving me any intensity. It's supposed to connect with me. I'm not supposed to connect with the room. That's wrong. Well, it's right for social subtype person.
So do certain cultures then maybe... people in a certain culture may move to one of the subtypes more?
Well, the interesting thing is, subtype is quite different than Enneagram style. Subtype is incredibly uniform, incredibly symmetrical. One third of the people are social subtype, one third are one to one, and one third are self preservation. It's unbelievable.
Gosh.
I went to an Enneagram conference, there were about 150 people there. And unbeknownst to us, there was a plan. And someone got up on the stage. We all knew our Enneagram types, you know, very clearly, because we were Enneagram teachers. Someone got up on the stage and said, I want you all to divide by subtype in the room. And we counted them up. 50, 50, 50. Now, that's probably a quirk, a fluke. But it tells you that it's very symmetrical. And nobody knows why. And the one-to-one people, they formed a circle, and it was incredibly somber. There was only one person speaking at a time. Everybody else was listening.
Yeah.
It was like there was this, you know, talking stick. It was being passed. The social subtype people retreated to another room. And someone said, all right, point of order, who wants to be the, what do you call it?
Who wants to
be the secretary to record? And then someone said, I move that we elect a leader. And they all voted and they had their leader. And it just came so naturally to them. And the self-preservation people went to another room. And they all pulled out their potato chips and their music, and their cookies and their drinks, and they started to feed each other and laugh.
Somehow that's counterintuitive. Yeah. When the social types wanted to get organized, and the self-preservationists, who seemed to be more inward, were treating each other less.
Well, it was amazing because self-preservation people are a little bit cautious. They look hesitant. They look shy, because they're trying to preserve and not put at risk. So when they got this uniformity of they were all self-preservation, the threat level went way down. And they got so exuberant, they were laughing and playing because they were all on the same page. And the one-to-one people had this intensity and this focus, and the one-to-one people said, hey, we could kick their asses.
And which room were you in?
Pardon me?
Which room were you in?
What do you think?
I think social.
No.
Self-preservation, because you smiled a lot when you said that. No?
No. Okay. I was trying to extend myself to appreciate their point of view. No, I'm one-to-one.
Really?
Yeah.
My teacher talked about, like, the belly types being anger. The core thing is anger, and then the head types is fear. And then I always got confused, like, then the heart points are, if one's anger and fear,
it's disconnection from love.
Disconnection.
Being forgettable, being forgotten, being unloved. And I don't like, I actually don't like the term social subtype, because it's misleading. Because it's not about being sociable. Mm-hmm. It's about your view of self extending out into a connectedness with other humans. And it's a little bit the same with this. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there for a second. Yes, thank you. It's not so much anger as if you feel like the context of what the world is throwing at you is trying to deprive you of your sacred sovereignty. I don't want to be what the world molds me to be. I want to be what I choose to be. And the context, the framework of the world is very molding, shaping, conditioning. So if it's like if your neighbor's playing loud music and 24/7 you're listening to something you don't want to listen to, and you can't make it stop, what are you going to do? You feel a force of, I don't want it like this. And that's what's meant by the anger. There's a force of, I'm being coerced, I'm being influenced, not of my choosing. I have not consented to this.
Do you see changes over the course of a lifetime?
Yeah, I think everybody agrees that Enneagram expression is most florid when we're adolescents. And we're trying to decode what this agenda of identity that we're saddled with really is.
So you think we're born with it?
Yeah, I do. I think we're born with it as a predilection, but it's sort of like a mold that doesn't exist yet. But somehow we find our way to the experiences that sort of create the identifiable mold, and then we build our identity to match. And then after 40, I think people start to get a little bit of dispassion to their own identity and sort of step back from it and start to view the mechanics and, you know, you have more data. You, wait a minute, I'm in the same stupid situation that I swore 20 years ago I would never do again? What gives here? And you start to notice how certain things repeat. And you, and if you're brave, you start to, well, the constant factor is me. So how exactly am I doing this? And then you investigate, and the Enneagram is a tremendous clarifying lens to support that investigation.
So when you said dispassionate, made me think of kind of unhooking from the strong identification with this particular type.
Yes. And I really think that all spiritual practices are connected to this. Mm-hmm. Right? You go for a Vipassana retreat and you just sit. And you're not being somebody, you're just being. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like going back to the paper that's underneath all of the information that's printed in the book.
It's burning.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just quickly want to say, where does nurture come into it at all? Nature versus nurture, in defining, or does it?
You have to make the linkage more clear to me. What you mean by that?
Well, how one is raised, the influences, parents, family, teachers, everybody.
I think it colors in your memories. Mm-hmm. But if in fact you're a one, if you had been born in a very different context and raised in a very different way, you would still be a one. You still would find your way to being a one, but you would have a whole different set of memories that substantiated your knowledge of yourself as a one. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much on behalf of Moon Rivers. And thank you all for coming out tonight. I want to point out that we have a donation bowl over on the counter there that we hope you will contribute to, because we share the proceeds with our speakers to support their work, and we retain the other half to support the existence of this space so that we can continue to have events like this in the future. I also want to point out that we have a number of books here on this little table here. That's not the entirety of the Enneagram books we have, but you can't get to the rest of them right now because the shelves are pushed back out of the way. But never